Okay, so let me start by reminding you of where we are with tensor networks. We started to look at tensor networks yesterday. We introduced the general idea that we replace, or we try to write the wave function of a many-body state as a collection of tensors that are connected through Born indices. And then to make things more concrete, we started with an example. The first non-trivial example that we looked at was the case where we think we consider quantum circuit acting on n spins or n d-level systems. So every line represents d-level system. And then what we have is a sequence of nearest neighbor gates involving two of these spins or two of these q digits. And we have t of such rows. Okay? So the depth of the circuit is t. We call this a depth t quantum circuit. And this is the state. So what we do is we parameterize state of n q digits by means of this quantum circuit, where what we are saying here is that we start with a product state and we end up with a highly entangled state. Okay? That we can use. We can quickly look at this and see, and recognize that that's of the form of a tensor network. There's a collection of tensors connected. We have open indices here, n open indices, which correspond to the sides of the lattice. And that's it. And then many Born indices connecting the different tensors. Okay? Is that example clear? I mean, is it clear what this means? Okay, so if you give me variational, so now we have all these gates. We have not specified what these gates are doing. Every time we specify what these gates are doing, we get a different state, a different many-body state. Okay, so all our variational parameters are hidden or are contained in these gates. All right, and what we wanted to do was to study generic properties of states that can be written in this way. We will not specify what these gates are. The only thing we use is that they are unitary, and that played some role. For instance, when we compute the scalar product of the state, we realized that this gate was annihilated by the conjugate, and that simplified the calculation a lot. Now, what we say then is, what we have is a checklist of properties. We would like every tensor network to fulfill properties A, B, and C. And we were going through these properties in the case of this tensor network. And property A was, well, is this tensor network an efficient representation of a many-body state? Okay? And what do we mean by this is, how many parameters do we need to completely specify this state? Well, the counting was simple. We look at the number of gates that we have. We have on the order of n gates, because each column, each row has, well, n over 2 gates, but let's call it n, times t rows. Okay, so we have n times t gates. We need to specify n times t gates. And how many coefficients do we need to specify each gate? Well, each gate is a map between c to the d square a Hilbert space into c to the d square Hilbert space, so each gate contains d to the fourth parameters. Okay? So the total number of coefficients that we need to completely specify states that can be written in this way is nt, the number of gates, times d to the fourth, which is the number of parameters on each gate. Okay? So that's how much parameters we need to specify, and you can see automatically that if t is polynomial in n, so if the depth of the circuit is only a polynomial in the number of qubits, then n times a poly n, that's still poly n, that's d to the fourth, which is does not depend on n, so we get that we have an efficient representation. Okay, we need poly n parameters to specify these states. Good, so property A is fulfilled, we have an efficient representation. Now, we need property B as well. Property B is, do we have an efficient way of computing things from this state? Do we have an efficient way of extracting expectation values of local observables? And let me remind you that, well, at the back of the notes from today, you'll have a copy of this if you don't have it with you anymore, or at least a few diagrams that I'm going to use right now. So we looked then at the computational cost of a local observable. And did you get to do anything about this last night, yesterday afternoon?
Yeah, it's a correlation
function. Even the correlation?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I wasn't sure how far you got. Okay, so that's really good. Right, so what we saw is that once we want to compute an expectation value of a local observable, suppose the local observable is sitting here, okay, then there is the notion of past causal cone of this region, this site, and what these gates mean, or this part of the circuit, this part of the circuit, the past causal cone, is the part of the circuit that we need to keep into account when we compute the expectation value of O. The rest of the circuit can go away. You still have annihilation of gates in the expectation value. That's something we saw yesterday. The important thing is that this length here is 2 times t. And this is an effective size that we have to deal with. And this leads to a computational cost that is exponential in t. Okay? Is that point clear? Is it clear why the cost is exponential in t? Is that a yes, no? Anybody, can anybody tell me why the cost is exponential in t? Nicole?
Imagine starting at the point that represents O and then moving up to all the gates that is affected or that affect it. You have to move up about t times and time that
okay. So it spreads all the way to, this causal cone spreads all the way to 2t, right? But that, why does this imply, sorry? Right, so what you need to deal is effectively with the Hilbert space corresponding to 2t qubits. And if you try to do that, I mean, you can try, this could be an exercise, try to contract the final tensor network that we had yesterday, which would be one of those that you have in here in figure 6.6, if it's still called 6.6. And you'll realize you can try hard as hard as you want. So given a tensor network, you always want to look at what strategy you have to follow to minimize the cost. I think that's something you saw yesterday. Is that correct, Dennis? So if they give you a tensor network, say a tensor network like this, and they tell you, find the best way to contract this tensor network. So let's assume that chi, that this index here takes chi values, okay, and that this index here takes d values. So that would be the scalar product of an MPS that we will see today. And I think you saw yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect, in the tutorial again. So you can always think, okay, I don't care which order I follow in order to contract this tensor network. Maybe I start with this index, and I join, that means I join these two tensors together. Then I multiply times this index, and I join these tensors together, and so on. So if you did that, you will end up with a tensor network that you still have to finish contracting that looks like this, okay? If you first contract these indices and these indices. Then if you look at this tensor network, this corresponds to psi and psi star, psi dagger. What you've done is you started with an efficient representation of a state, right? You use a tensor network to efficiently represent this state. But the first thing you did was to go and contract the indices in such a way that you obtain the whole wave function, which is not efficient. This guy, the number of parameters here is d to the n. Okay, so you've built an object that contains d to the n coefficients. That is exponential in n. Okay, that defeats the purpose of everything we've been doing. So you have to be very careful how you contract your tensor network, which sequence of two tensor contractions you follow. For instance, the right way to do this is by following another order where you put these guys together, then you add another one, then you add another one, and you do it sequentially in this way, in such a way that you never get anywhere close to rebuilding the whole wave function. Okay, and that's essential. So when you see a tensor network diagram and you think, okay, let's contract this, don't follow just any order of contraction because the cost depends on the order you follow. There are strategies that will not be efficient. Now, what happens with the tensor network that we would have to compute in this case is that if you, it doesn't matter how hard you try, okay, you'll realize that you have to build objects that are exponentially large. Okay, that you'll have to build. So you will see. You can follow. You can try as hard as you want. You will end up building objects with a number of legs that ends up being proportional to t. Okay, and this is why you'll find that the cost is exponential in t. Okay. So that's bad news. We had these answers. It gave us an efficient representation of states, but the cost is exponential in t. So if we want this to also be, if we want this to also be an efficient tensor network from which we can efficiently compute expectation values, then we'll have to take t. So this implies that we have to take t to be on the order of at most log n. Okay. So what we're saying is that yes, this could be a useful tensor network in the sense of also being able, we will be able to efficiently compute expectation values if this only grows at most as log n, right? So that would mean we have n qubits, very large system, and the width or the depth of this quantum circuit can only be logarithmic in the number of qubits. It has to be a small depth quantum circuit. Okay, and then what you saw, I hear that what you saw during the tutorial, and this is represented in figure 6.6, I believe, this figure here, is that when we look at correlations, okay, if you take this as an ansatz, this quantum circuit, and you look at a two-point correlator where the two operators are at a distance L, where L is larger than 2t, what you see is that the expression that you have to compute factorizes into a product of two expressions, okay? And then is that, that's
yeah,
covered,
this,
right? Okay. So, and these two expressions, these expressions correspond to the local, so what we find is that psi, okay, that when we compute the expectation value of a local observable on one side and another observable on another side, separated by a distance L, which is larger than 2t, that this automatically factorizes into precisely what you would have if you compute the expectation value of the first observable on one side, and separately you compute the expectation value of the other observable on the other side. Okay? And therefore, any connected correlator is zero. Okay? That happens as soon as we have this condition, large distances. Okay? So that's a very strange state. If you look at, there are no correlations after some characteristic length. No correlations at all. All right? Okay, and they didn't look into the entropy, is that correct? No entropies.
Yeah, they didn't.
Okay. So we have this property. Let me tell you what this reminds me of. So this property says no correlations if you look at sufficiently large distances. But if we had a gap system, so the ground state of a gap system in one dimension, remember that these correlations would decay exponentially with distance. So replacing exponential decay, so exponential decay, once you are beyond the correlation length, that's a very fast decay. These numbers are very small. So maybe these ansatz could work well with systems with a finite correlation length. Maybe these ansatz could be a reasonable approximation, okay, where we decide that this at some point becomes negligible for ground states of gap systems in one dimension. Okay, so let's keep thinking along these lines. Maybe this is a good ansatz for ground states of gap systems. And now let's try to find, and this would be the next figure, figure 6.7. Let's try to find how the entropy of a block of length L scales with L. Okay? We want to look at the entropy, entanglement entropy. How much entanglement does this final state here actually have? Okay? And I want to point out once more that we're looking at properties where we have not specified any of the variational parameters. So these are structural properties. They are common to any or to a generic state that you can write in this way. So we've seen that the correlators decay, and now let's look at the entropy. So for that, I need to go back to last week. Last week, we talked about the Smith decomposition. So suppose that we have a bipartite system, system made of two parts A and B, in a pure state. Okay? And last week, we talked about the canonical way of writing this state of A and B. We call it the Smith decomposition, and we talked about the Smith rank. We had the Smith rank. Now, I want to mention, because that will be very useful here, that if we have a decomposition of a bipartite state, which is not the Smith decomposition, okay? So if you are able to write your state using chi tilde terms in a decomposition of this form, and if you want, now we have tensor networks, so we could just say, okay, this looks like this. And this index here, this index will be I, running from 1 to chi tilde. Okay? If we can write the Smith state in this form, then the Smith decomposition will give us at most as many terms. Okay? At most as many terms. So what we have is that if we can decompose our state for part A and B as a tensor network connected by a single index that takes chi tilde values, then we know that the Smith rank is upper bounded by chi tilde. Okay? This is an observation. You probably saw something similar. For instance, remember this case, right? We had state 0, 0. We said, OK, product state, Smith rank 1. That was obvious. But then when we have state 0, 1 plus 0, 0, okay, now you see this is a decomposition of this form. We use two terms. Nevertheless, you already know that this can be rewritten in this way. Right? So this is an example where chi tilde would be equal to 2, and yet the Schmidt rank is equal to 1. It's an example where you have a bipartite decomposition in terms of states for A and B and a sum of those, where the number of terms you have here is larger than the Schmidt rank. Okay? Nicole? That's right. Fair enough. I would have to explain that phi I is equal in some basis j, some matrix ij sum over j. So you would have a matrix C connecting the index j, and that's getting really busy. But the idea is that this, if you want to express these states in a local basis, in some pre-established local basis for part A, you would need a change of basis here. So that would be a change of basis for these states. This would be a change of basis for those states. And this tensor here is corresponds to these coefficients. Maybe that's not an obvious choice, the most natural choice of example to illustrate that. But the idea that you need to get from here is that if you have a tensor network representation where you can split part A from B by cutting just one index, then the rank of this, the number of values that this index takes, so chi tilde, automatically gives you an upper bound to the Schmidt rank. Okay? Another observation, which is closely related, if you can write a density matrix as a sum of chi tilde terms involving cats and bras, okay, where this is not the eigenvalue decomposition, okay, then automatically you know that the rank of this density matrix, the number of linearly independent columns or the number of linearly independent rows of this density matrix, is also upper bounded by chi tilde, okay, by the number of terms in this decomposition. And this, these two upper bounds are closely related to each other. Remember that the rank of the density matrix is the same, of the reduced density matrix for part A is the same as the Schmidt rank for the state. Okay? And in terms of a Schmidt, of a diagram for this, what we say is that if you can write your density matrix as a tensor network where you would be able to cut, maybe I should use another color here. We can cut, as in here, the tensor network into a part for A and a part for B by only cutting a single index that takes chi tilde values, then that's an upper bound here for the Schmidt rank. In this case, it will be an upper bound for the rank of row. Okay? So the idea is we ask the question, different parts of the system, say part A and part B, or the bra and the cat part of our density matrix, how connected these two parts are, okay? And this is given by the number of terms that we have in these decompositions, chi tilde. Automatically, that's an upper bound to the rank of the density matrix or to the Schmidt rank of a bipartite state. And so we're going to use this in figure 6.7, which I'm not going to draw. What you can see is that when you compute the reduced density matrix for in this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 spins, you have some complicated tensor network, which looks roughly like so you end up with some tensor network. I don't write the details, but the important thing is that it's connected by a number of indices. So this is the density matrix for the part that we didn't trace out. And what we see is that if we wanna separate the indices corresponding to the bra from the indices corresponding to the cat, we have to cut. Okay, and the number of indices that we're cutting is equal, this number of indices happen to be 2t. We cut 2t indices. Now each index has dimension d. So effectively, these indices have dimension d to the 2t. Okay, so that's like our chi tilde. We have a number of indices together. They form a composite index of dimension d to the 2t. And that defines chi tilde. So we could replace all these indices with a single index with dimension d to the 2t. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the rank of this density matrix is smaller or equal than chi tilde, which is equal to d to the 2t. Okay? We know that this density matrix has a rank that at most is exponential in t. And now remember, we saw that the entropy of a density matrix was at most log 2 of this rank. And therefore, in this case, that's at most log 2 of d to t, which is equal to 2t log of d. So what we see is that any state that can be represented with this quantum circuit, when you look at the reduced density matrix for a block of any number of subsystems, then the entropy that we obtain is at most this number here, which does not depend on L, right? So that would be, so what we find is the entropy of a block of size L is at most 2t log 2d. There is no dependence on L. So this is just a constant. Okay? What we see is that when we compute any density matrix, the connectivity between the brass and the cat is fixed. It's always a number of indices which is independent of the size of the block. So what we find then is we've seen correlations. They decay, they vanish after some distance, and we've seen entanglement. The entanglement is a constant. But this is also compatible or similar to what happens for gap, for ground states of gap systems in one dimension.
And in this regard, these subsystems, they are the same, or they can be arbitrary upper.
So this is coming. This is coming from that picture,
mm-hmm.
where each side has dimension d. Mm-hmm. Right. So all the lines that I'm drawing here are correspond to vector spaces of dimension d.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and you have the details in this figure. Okay. So what have we seen? We've seen that we've started with a particular example of tensor network. And for this particular example of tensor network, we checked three properties. It's an efficient representation that is a very loose. This just tells us this should be polynomial in N. But then when we look at efficient computational cost, then we see that T has to be at most log n, okay? And then when we looked at the properties that it has, so how correlations scale or entanglement scales, then we find properties that are consistent, or at least in an approximate way, with ground states of gap systems. Now, in one dimension. Now, what we could do then is to say, okay, I'm gonna choose T. We're going to choose T, okay? We make a choice now. We say T, we will not even make it depend on log n. We're going to choose T equal to the correlation length in the system that I want to study. It's a constant. So if we choose T to be a constant, the correlation length in the system that we want to study, then we go to efficient representation. Oh, that's fine. The number of parameters is only, now it's only linear. It's only linear in N, okay? So you have a very nice scaling of the number of parameters. It's linear in the system size, not exponentially, but linear. If you look at the computational cost, you replace exponential of T by exponential of the correlation length. And you say, oh, that's perfect, because this cost does not scale with the system size, okay? So we can compute expectation values of local operators with a cost that is not even linear in the system size, just a constant. Then we look at properties, and we see that what's happening is that when we look at the two-point correlator at a distance larger than the correlation length, the two-point correlator becomes zero. Okay, it shouldn't be zero, but it would be already very small if we had the real ground state. So that's an acceptable approximation. And when we look at the entropy, we find that the entropy is bounded by a constant, and that's exactly what we find in ground states of gap systems in one dimension. So what we find, the conclusion is that we've introduced an example of tensor network, a very simple one based on a quantum circuit, and we've studied all the properties that it fulfills, and we find that if the depth of the quantum circuit is proportional to the correlation length of the system that we would like to study, this could be a good, useful tensor network for it. Okay? All right. So, are there questions?
First I would like to confirm that. So, when you are saying that T, so now you replace the T by what is it called?
She. Correlation length.
Oh, yeah, correlation length. Then, do you mean that you just contract all the all those gates outside the quota point, so that this system only have, I mean, it's like decay.
No, I still have this quantum circuit. I'm just saying that now, if the correlation length in, so suppose I want to study ground state of a system where the correlation length is equal to five lattice spacing. So I come here and say, OK, this is going to be equal to five. It means I'm considering these ansatz where the number of rows of gates, there are only five rows of gates, right? You could even consider now a very large system, right? Maybe the thermodynamic limit. If, for instance, if you include translation invariance, all these gates could be the same. And then you just have to give me this gate, this gate, this gate, this gate. Okay, let's say correlation length is four. Okay. You give me these four gates and you repeat them everywhere. And you can do this forever. Okay, in principle. And now you ask how much is the expectation value of a local observable. The whole calculation will be reduced to a finite size calculation. So you could even consider a system in the thermodynamic limit. Okay? N could be infinite. You still have, so in this case, if you consider translation invariance, the number of parameters does no longer depend on N because you are just copying the same parameters everywhere. Okay? And you have an ansatz that allows you to efficiently represent states of an infinite lattice. Now, what are the limitations? The limitations are these two. Correlations vanish after a certain distance. And the entanglement contained in a region is at most a given constant that you have.
So you try to like control the correlation by setting the depth of the tensor network to a finite value. However, you can like choose whatever n.
Yeah, yeah, yes. In case of translation invariance, yes.
And also, just to make sure that, so in that Smith decomposition, the middle matrix, is it like, does it look like a diagonal matrix, but with like.
It happens to be a diagonal matrix, yes.
Yeah, but.
But it's not important. So you could have sum over I and J, IJ. J, and this would be I, and this would be I, and this would be J. The important thing is that there is an index that you can cut so that you can split the bra from the get, and this index is only taking chi tilde values. That automatically gives you an upper bound on the rank.
However, I suppose the matrix in the middle is diagonal, it has the index run from I to the chi tilde. However, there are only chi non-zero entries.
No. We are not assuming. There are no, here, look at this example. There are no non-zero entries here. You have two terms with coefficients 1 and 1, right? So chi tilde here is 1. I mean, that is not an example for rho. It's for the bipartite state. But it's illustrating the same thing, that when you write a sequence of bipartite terms, product states, this number in the sequence, chi tilde, does not give you the Schmidt rank. It gives you an upper bound to the Schmidt rank. The Schmidt rank has to be that number or smaller. Okay? Okay. Any other question?
For this particular ansatz, how do we know that it's okay to substitute the correlation length for t and not say correlation length squared or correlation length times 100 or something?
So maybe correlation length times 100 would be a better thing, right? But the idea is that you have correlations, if you have the correlations go as exponential of minus L over correlation length, then if L is equal to, say, 10 times the correlation length, okay, then the correlator, so the correlator when L is equal to 10 times the correlation length, is on the order of exponential of minus 10. You see, it's very small. Okay? So the idea is once you have, so you said maybe 10 times. Okay, yeah. Maybe x times. Automatically you get e to the minus x. So you decide what type of approximation you want. What is acceptable to you? Is it 0.1 or is it, so can you replace 0.1 with 0 or can you replace 10 to the minus 5 with 0? You decide. But it's going to be some number times the correlation length. And that's how you want to choose the length of the circuit, the depth of this circuit. Okay? Of course, this answer then is reasonable if you have a small correlation length, but the cost are still exponential in the correlation length. So suppose you are following a system that gets closer and closer to a quantum critical point, so where the correlation length becomes arbitrarily large, then you don't want to use these answers, okay? Because the cost is going to be exponential in this correlation length. Okay, so this was the first example, and now we should move on with the truth is nobody uses these answers, okay? But I think it's a good answer to illustrate the basic ideas. Now we can move to the real thing. And so now I'm going to tell you about a matrix product states. And let me start with the definition. So we have our wave function. And this is the wave function for a lattice system where we have n sides. So we'll have n open indices, one for each side. And this, again, is a tensor. Remember, it would take d to the n parameters to specify. And instead of that, we'll replace it, or we'll write it as a collection of tensors. So I1, I2, IN, I1, I2, IN. OK? We're going to try to write state of n sides as a tensor network of this form, as a one-dimensional array of tensors.
I think this is the second time you've given a definition like this. That's not the kind of definition I'm used to from physics classes.
OK.
What is the definition in?
No, I'm trying to define. So this is not the definition, right? The section is definition. I'm going to try to define what I mean by a matrix product state. OK? So when we say matrix product state, what do we mean? Is a tensor network of this form, where you now know what this diagram means. It means you have a collection of tensors. Say this tensor has three indices, and we connect one index with a tensor to the left, to the right, and one index to the, with a tensor to the left. Okay. Okay. So now I would like to discuss why the properties A, B, and C for this particular ansatz, all right? For this particular tensor network. So 7.2, I'm going to look at property A, efficient description. So it turns out that if we decide that this Bond index, each of the Bond indices, take at most chi values, okay, chi values, then what we have is that we have n tensors, and just for to make it nicer, let me connect them this way, okay? So if I connect them this way, this is known as periodic boundary conditions matrix product state. I will be using MPS. That's how everybody in the field refers to matrix product states. MPS here, MPS there. So that would be an MPS, matrix product state, with periodic boundary conditions. If I don't include this line, then it's an MPS or matrix product state with open boundary conditions. In any case, we have n tensors. Each tensor is of the form, is of this form, where this index, this the bond index, we just set that takes chi different values. And what we call the physical index, the one relating to a side on the lattice, takes d values. Okay? So how many values do we, how many coefficients do we need to specify a tensor? Somebody? How many coefficients do we need to specify a tensor where we have three indices?
Chi squared and d.
Sorry?
Chi squared and d.
Right. So the number of coefficients for one tensor is chi squared times d. Okay? That's how many coefficients we have in a tensor where we have three indices and this index has dimension chi, this one has dimension chi, and this one has dimension d. And now, how many tensors do we have? So we have n of them. So the total number of coefficients that we use to specify a state written as a matrix product state is order n chi squared d, okay? Where chi is some value that we fix. So every time we fix chi to some value, we get a representation where the number of coefficients scales linearly in the system size. And that's a good thing, okay? Scaling that is linear. It's not polynomial. So we have an efficient representation, efficient description, okay? Now, before we go to see whether we have an efficient computation or not, let me try to describe what's happening here. So what we have is the vector space. If this is the vector space on n sides, what we have is that the dimension is d to the n. So this would be a huge vector space. The dimension of this vector space is exponential in n. Okay. Now, if we look at product states, so imagine we have states with no entanglement. These are states in this Hilbert space, right? They are part of this Hilbert space. But it turns out that they are a very small subset. What do we mean by small? Well, there's a way of calling this small, which is we look at the dimension of this guy here. The dimension is order n. So n times d. You need n times d coefficients to specify any product state. So these are product states. Remember, product states are defined as those that have no entanglement. Okay? Now, what we're doing here, actually, if you set chi equal to 1, so if this bond index becomes trivial, then you recover product states. So a matrix product state, you can understand it as a generalization of a product state, where suddenly you have an index connecting the different parts of the system. Or in other words, you allow for entanglement. So now chi could take several values. Suppose chi is equal to 1. Then we cover everything that is inside here. So that would be, now we have a matrix product state. Sorry, chi equal to 2. Matrix product state with chi equal to 2. Okay, we cover more of this Hilbert space. We could have chi equal to 3. Then chi equal to 3 covers chi equal to 2, product states, and more, and so on. And so you can keep doing this. And you can ask, so this could be some chi. It would cover some part of the Hilbert space. So this, what this means is you will be able to represent some subset of all the states in the Hilbert space. Not all of them, only some subset. Okay. What do you have to do in order to cover all of them? Well, piece of cake. Take chi to be exponentially large in n. So if we choose chi, so if you choose chi on the order of d to the n half, okay, exponentially large. So if this bond index is allowed to be arbitrarily large or grow with exponentially with n, then we'll be able to cover the whole Hilbert space. Okay? Now, for finite chi, fixed chi, chi independent of n, which is what we care about because that's when we have an efficient description, we can only cover some part of the whole Hilbert space. We will only be able to represent a subset of states in the many-body system. Okay? But our hope is that ground states of local Hamiltonians, at least gapped Hamiltonians in one dimension, that they will be here, that they will all be concentrated in here, that we will not need to go arbitrarily away from these matrix product states for finite chi in order to obtain a good approximation to ground states of one-dimensional system. And so what I'll do today and part of tomorrow is explain why these matrix product states that can be written in this way, why we think or will provide evidence that they have, again, properties consistent with ground states of one-dimensional systems with a gap. So what are we going? What's our goal is to show that these type of states are a good approximation to ground states of gap Hamiltonians in one dimension. Okay? So that's what, in practice, people use matrix product states for, to approximate ground states of one-dimensional systems for gap Hamiltonians. And I have to say that we will not see, we will not prove that they are a good approximation. What we will see is that this ansatz has the same, so automatically when you write a state in this way, the resulting state has properties which are consistent with the properties that you expect in a ground state of a gap Hamiltonian in one dimension. In particular, we'll see exponential decay of correlations and again, that the entanglement entropy saturates. Was there a question?
Are you defining matrix products as having chi equals
2? Am I defining matrix product states as what?
As having chi equals 2?
No. I define them as states that can be written in this way. And then we'll use them when chi is some fixed number, independent of n. So a matrix product state can be written in this way. You can actually prove, and I will skip this because it's just too technical, that any state in here can be written in this way. So any, that if you choose the one dimension, chi, to be large enough, you can cover anything you want, okay? So when we say we can write a state as a matrix product state, we say, okay, we haven't learned anything because any state can be written in this way. The key question is how much is the one dimension? Okay? If the one dimension is exponentially large, fine. You have just rewritten your exponentially large vector in terms of exponentially large tensors. You didn't gain anything. Now there is a context in which matrix product states are useful, which is when the one dimension can be kept small. In this case, we have an efficient description. And we also have an efficient computation. And this is something that we will look into in a minute. And that's the context where matrix product states are used in practice. OK? So chi, did I answer, Nicole? Chi is not 2. It's any finite number that you will choose. We should say a matrix product state will rank chi.
So how do you explain
There is no physical meaning to be explained. What you have to explain is why you are doing that, because it's not a useful decomposition. You're replacing, so when chi is exponential, is that what you're asking? When chi is exponential in n,
yeah.
Then you shouldn't be even using this. So it's a matrix product state is a canonical way of writing any multipartite state. Okay? And you can write any state. So you cannot talk about generic properties in that regime. because any state could be written in this way. What's interesting is when you fix chi to a constant independent of n, of the system size, then we'll see that we have a number of properties. Properties, a scaling of entanglement, a scaling of correlations. All right? Good. Then, are there more questions?
So basically, you know, the earlier lecture you tried to give a motivation, say, the things we discussed last time is a good approximation for this 1D gap system.
Yes.
You see the correlation
part. That's right.
And you now propose a better way to deal with this metric product state. And you show every kind of this notation of side with other legs can always write this metric product state. And I wonder, say, do you have intuition why this is better? Maybe you're already sure, but I didn't really understand why this proposal is.
Why this good?
It's better than this.
That's what we will see. So the intuition will come with practical examples, with the properties that I want to describe. There is one thing to be said, though, which is let me consider a matrix product state with open boundary conditions. So that would be the state of a spin chain. Let me start this in the meantime. So this leg here is connecting left and right. You can think of this as A and this as B. So you can divide your lattice into parts A and B. That's a bipartite system now. And it turns out that this bond index here, you could use it to encode, to describe, or to label the Schmidt coefficients. So what I'm saying by this is that this index here, alpha, could go from 1 all the way to chi, where chi is the Schmidt rank. What's happening is that you can consider for any bipartition of your, so that's a one-dimensional system. You have your sides, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Now you could. So we could divide the system into two parts, A and B. And this is going to be, this index here is actually going to be related to the Schmidt rank of this decomposition of our bipartite state into part A and B. And the same for each index. Each index will, if we break the index, we have a division of the system into part A and B. And this index then is going to be, the number of values of this index is going to be the Schmidt rank of that bipartition. Okay, so for every bipartition, we get the Schmidt decomposition. And for each Schmidt decomposition, we have a Schmidt rank. And what I'm saying is that this index is the responsible for representing entanglement between part A and B. When we change to another index, this index is responsible for representing entanglement for this new A and this new B, entanglement across this partition. That's true. That's true. What I'm saying, that's right. So what I'm saying is that we could choose these indices such that the bound would be saturated. Yes. Okay. So what do we want to do now? I want to talk about the computational cost of computing expectation values with a matrix product state. And that's something that you had a look last night, right? Okay, so let's just review it here. So what we see here, and now I have to turn light slow. Okay. So we are considering states that can be written in this way. Okay? That's our tensor network ansatz for a state. So once we have a state that is written in this way, we want to look at how to compute quantities such as the scalar product. So on the top line, what you have is the representation of psi ket. And lower down here, what you have is psi bra. Okay? So the scalar product comes from multiplying these two tensor networks together. Yes?
How do you know that the bottom row represents the other psi as opposed to some other
vector pi.
Right, you don't know it from this representation. I'm saying that if I wanted to represent this, I would have to use a tensor network of this form. If I wanted to represent the scalar product between psi and psi prime, it will also look like this. Okay? And the tensor network contractions that you would have to perform would be exactly the same. So when I'm saying that we're going to look at how to compute the scalar product, actually we're looking at a more general situation where we could be computing psi times psi prime. That's right. Okay? So this is what we want to accomplish. We want to compute the scalar product. And we already discussed the silly way of doing this, which is you can multiply all these indices together, the upper indices, so that we end up creating the wave function, the whole wave function. So one possibility would be to multiply all the upper indices together to end up with a single tensor with n legs, and all the lower Born indices together, and we would create this object. Now, as I said, this wave function, this tensor up here, has a size which is exponential in the number of spins, so that's not a good idea. Okay, but I think you had a look at this yesterday during the tutorial. And hopefully this was the conclusion you reached, which is that you can actually compute, extract the number. So this is a tensor network without open indices. This is some number. And you can compute it by acting sequentially or contracting sequentially from one side to the other, where the first step would be to put, so this represents the first segment of this tensor network. We would multiply this tensor times this tensor. Okay, and so that tensor here represents the result of this multiplication. So in going from here to here, we replaced the first two tensors with a single tensor. And now, what's the cost of this manipulation? You also learn that, right? That the cost of multiplying tensors, two tensors together, is the product of all the indices involved. So if we have that this index, Born index takes chi values, this index here takes d values, and this other index takes chi values, the cost is chi squared d, okay? Chi times d. So we get to this situation, right? We replace these two tensors with a single one, and now we multiply this new tensor times this tensor. And when we do that, what's the cost? Well, the cost is going to be, again, the product of all the dimensions involved. This is chi times chi times chi times d. So it's chi to the 3 times d, okay? And this operation allows us to replace these two tensors with a single tensor, okay? And what's important about this cost is that there is no n involved, okay? It's not d to the n. It's not exponential. It's not even linear. We're just dealing with matrices or tensors, small tensors. We multiply them together. There is some cost that does not depend on n. And so once we are here, we can proceed. That's getting systematic now. We can multiply this tensor times this tensor to obtain a new tensor. Now, what's the cost? Well, we have chi times d. So chi 3 d. That's the cost to go from this part of the diagram to this one. Okay. And now what we realize is, well, look, we are here, but this looks very much like where we were before. It's only that we have one pair less, okay, of tensors. So what I'm saying is that now we could just iterate these two steps and proceed along the whole chain, okay? And the cost of these steps is chi to the 3 times d. Every time, so with chi to the 3 times d times 2, because we did this twice, we managed to go from here to here, which brings us one step to the right. And how many times do we have to do this? Well, now it's where n comes in. We have to do this n times until we get to the n, right? So the cost of all this contraction is n times chi 3 to the d. Okay? So that's really good news. Cost. is chi 3 to the d times n, sorry. So order, so it's linear in n. It's linear in n, OK? We went from exponential in n to linear in n. And what else can we say here? So suppose we want to compute the expectation value now of an observable, where the observable is sitting somewhere here. So that could be a local observable. It's an observable on one side. Suppose this is a spin chain. You want to compute the expectation value of a sigma y or sigma x or whatever. Okay. So we have, this is the ket. This is the observable that we want to measure. And this is the bra. Okay. And now we have to contract this tensor network. Well, the simple observation here that is useful is that I can take, I look at these three tensors here. I just draw them separately here. And I realize that I can multiply this times this with a cost that is, well, let's look at the indices involved. So this is d, d, chi, chi. So it's going to be, oh, that should be d squared. OK, so chi squared, d squared. OK, the cost is chi squared, d squared. And we obtain that we can replace these two tensors with a new tensor. Now, if we bring that back in, we end up with a structure that is of the similar to psi times psi, or in this case, psi prime times psi, right? But as we discussed a moment ago, we know how to do that, OK? So the cost is, again, chi is 3 d n, maybe plus chi squared d squared. But typically, that is a constant with respect to n. And now we could do the same for many other observables, as long as they can be written as a product of local observables. OK, so the good news is I'm only 4 minutes late. It's my personal record. And I will leave it here until tomorrow, unless there are questions, of course.